Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. Spectrum of Care, Dr. Ryan Engler, communication. I hope you're all sitting down. And if you're driving in your car, you might want to pull over for this one because there's a lot of great information that we're going to be learning about. How are you, my friend?
Oh my gosh, it's great to see you. Hello to you. Hello to everybody out there.
You know, you're one of the few people, I have on my to-do. You have a to-do list post-COVID of people that I need to hug and squeeze. And you're my number one person that I have left that I need to see.
I know, because you give good hugs. Yours are like the A-plus hug.
Right, I know. So I need to see you in person to get into conferences, of course, and but so good to see you. So we are going to be chatting a lot. She is an author. She's a veterinarian. She works on the faculty at University of Arizona. So that's a little bit about our friend. If you don't know who she is, she graduated from Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine in 2008. Got to give a shout out. She practiced as an associate veterinarian in companion animal practice before transitioning into the educational circuit as an advocate for preclinical training and primary care, which is awesome. And she debuted in academia as a clinical instructor in the community practice service at Cornell University's Hospital for Animals, and then transitioned the role of assistant professor as founding faculty at Midwestern University. And while at Midwestern University, she had the opportunity to teach the inaugural class of 2018, 2019, and the class of 2020. So let's stop and put pause on that for a second, because I know you're really big on communication. What was that like for you going through, not knowing that COVID was going to be coming? What was that like moments before and leading up to and after?
Great question. I think for me, and I experienced COVID right after, the pandemic, like we all did as surprise, but right after I moved to transition to University of Arizona, College of Vet Medicine, and I had come to Tucson, Arizona, I think in January of 2020 or whatnot. And all of a sudden found myself building the school. We were going to open the doors in August. And then suddenly, well, what do we do? And my hat that I wear many hats, like most of us out there, all of us out there. I teach clinical skills and communication. And so the clinical skills, the hands-on, the how do we draw blood, the how do we put IV catheters in, how do we suture? To me, it was always a given. We would make it work. We'd find a way to have people in person. And so we opened our doors in August, and I was one of the few faculty that was on site all the time. So minimum changes for me, other than we had to have the obligatory smaller groups, smaller students. So I would teach the same class or the same lab 10 or 12 times to get everybody in so that we could be spaced. And the students were amazing. I mean, they flexed to wearing masks, face shield, goggles when we needed that, anything we needed, they were game for, because they realized we all were in it together to build those skills. And I felt it was valuable for that face time.
Yeah. And I can only imagine how so multiple silver linings that have come from that. But I think communication must have been top of mind for the students as well as yourselves in order to successfully, talk about where you're going, where you're heading with procedures. Was communication, have you noticed that was something that was well done by these students?
I think so. I think what really advanced us is this emphasis on transparency. And ironically, that's something I'd studied in my research years prior on what clients want, right? What skills do they want to see in the exam room, and what skills are we not as good at? And transparency was the one I was not teaching originally when I taught at Midwestern. Research said, hey, we're missing that gap. Let's put it in. And now fast forward to my time at University of Arizona, all of a sudden in the pandemic, we had no answers for so many things. And so oftentimes I'd have to say to students, I don't know where we're going to go with it, but this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to flex. Or I don't know what next week will hold. I don't know what tomorrow will hold, but this is the plan. And if we don't get to do the plan, this is what we're going to do instead. And I think that led to modeling, so that I feel like our students are more comfortable with flexing. They're more comfortable being adaptable. And they were willing to go with it because I said, I'm in it too. we were all making that commitment to be there together and to weather the storm. And so I'm really proud of them for pulling through, because everything else was on Zoom for them. And so it was the one time we had to touch point and be together.
That's a great example of teamwork too in the veterinary school setting, for sure. So yeah, again, to the listeners, she's been at the University of Arizona College of Veterinary Medicine. She serves as a dual appointment, associate professor of practice and executive director of clinical and professional skills. And so with that, you know, top of mind, Dr. Engler, is spectrum of care. And I kind of want to peel back the curtain a little bit more and, you know, share with the listeners, basically defining what that is. Is there such thing as a gold standard anymore? So share with me your thoughts on spectrum of care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to start by saying spectrum of care is a new word for an old concept. And it's something that, I mean, I remember when I was 14 years old, working in the kennel at a companion animal practice, looking up to the veterinarians I wanted to be like. And I saw this each day, every day. They were practicing this. There wasn't a term for it. So I want to start by giving kudos to those who were pioneers without even knowing it. And now it's evolved into this buzz phrase, which is good because we're talking about it. But what it is really honoring the traditional approach by innovative thinkers to really advancing care and tailoring it to the patient. And so when we think of spectrum of care, we think about moving away from saying there's one right way to treat this patient with this condition. So it's looking at pet-specific care from a standpoint of what most of us think about, we go straight to cost. So sometimes when we think about spectrum of care, we think, okay, for that fracture repair, we could do the $1,000 external fixator orthopedic surgeon referral, or, and we think about plan B or plan C or plan D as spectrum of care. But I'd really encourage us to think about it beyond just cost, and think about all the other avenues it relates to. So whether that's accessibility to care, can clients actually get to the clinic? Can they drive there? Can they get transported there? Is a specialist around? What is their geographical representation in that area? Do we have resources that they can draw upon? Are there language barriers? Are there other barriers to owners being able to give care at home? Right. A lot of times I remember as a baby vet, I would just give the clients, these are the orders. This is what you're going to do. I never checked in to see if they could do it. And some of my epic failures were the patients that they were cats. I remember I love cats, and I disadvantaged cats so many times because I would say to the owner of this fractious cat, here's the Clavamox pill. You're going to go home and give the Clavamox. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, the cat's not better. And the owner's like, I didn't give the medicine. And I'm like, why not? Right. What happened? And they're like, well, the cat only takes liquid medications. And I think, oh, crap, I could have prescribed the liquid. Right. So there are these little thought bubbles that happen with experience of just something as simple as in, what do you need? Can you give the medicine? Are you equipped? What is your time commitment? Right. All of those sorts of things.
You know, it's so powerful that we're talking about this. And a simple scenario that I'll share with you myself is I had, when I was practicing full time, I tend to have a senior clientele just where we were located. And I always try to keep that top of mind. But, you know, when you're so busy, you just forget. And I had a really wonderful client, and she's like, she called up the receptionist after she went home. She's like, I didn't want to tell Dr. Christman because I felt embarrassed, but I can't physically twist the bottle, you know, and again, to your point, it's simple things like that, she says, I thought I could, I was trying to do it with a dish towel and I tried to open it. I felt terrible, you know? And I like that we're talking about these front and center, these questions, especially to students, the vet students, to know, like, these are some things and barriers that we don't really necessarily, you forget, because sometimes you're going you're busy, you forget, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right? We are so on target and on compass and on track, and our GPSs get the patient in, get them fixed. And we forget sometimes that the fixing requires that conversation. And that's really what I would say is about what spectrum of care excels at. It's how do we have that partnership so that we can create the safe space of, hold on, let's put a pause on that. What do we need to do, and can we do it? And also, should we for that patient? Because the gold standard, for example, that I was trained to treat a feline urinary tract obstruction or canine parvovirus, they're grounded in evidence base, but we forget there's also other evidence bases to support outpatient care or care when we can't do everything. And rather than think of that care as lesser, think about it as something in our toolbox. It's another tool, right? The gold standard might have been the hammer. Maybe this tool is the wrench. That's okay. Maybe the wrench works. Let's look at why that works and how we can build a case for making it even more successful.
Do you think spectrum of care, the most under that umbrella term, the most common concern or educational piece is the money component, or is it part of everything else?
Great question. I think when I first broached the topic with my students, most of the time we go straight to money, right? Mm-hmm. People will say, okay, this is the, you know, I'll present a clinical vignette, parvovirus, how do we treat it? And often there's very two disparate approaches, the go home and hope we live versus the let's do everything that we're taught in internal medicine. And when I ask, well, why is that, right? What is this discrepancy? Cost is always what comes back. But then we start to dissect it further and we say, all right, now let's say the owner has won the lottery. There's no cost, right? I do a lot of theoreticals with them. What else do we need to consider, right? What else is there? And that's when you peel back those layers and you start to think, well, what is the language access for this client? How do they learn from resources? Can they give medications at home, right? Where do they live relative to the patient? Can we hospitalize? Do we have a 24-hour clinic? Right? Maybe they have the finances to do everything we want for the gold standard, except we don't have a clinic that's open 24/7 to do around-the-clock intensive care. And then students, the little light bulbs go off and you start thinking, oh, okay, it's really this huge picture of really what do we need to customize. In the same way, I know it sounds terrible, but the same way you go to Starbucks and customize your caramel macchiato. Nobody wants the same caramel macchiato. You want to make it fit for you, right? And so how do we make that work? Because the patient has needs, the owner has needs, right? Another good example would be gold standard care for the chronic renal failure cat, right? CKD. Maybe the owner is very willing to do sub-Q fluids. And the owner's bought into the gold standard of what we think should happen. But the cat says, heck no, see you later. I'm going under the bed. I'm not tolerating that. Well, now we have a situation where the owner was wanting to do it. The vet wanted to, but doing everything erodes that relationship. So we need to scale back. And again, it's not lesser. It's actually helping the cat's quality of life.
And so many, we live in a time now where we're all about individualized care. I feel like no dog that walks through our hospital or cat has the same wants and needs as the next pet parent that's out there. And what I love about, and I would like to get your opinion on this, because I do think this is under a spectrum of care, is that when we customize vaccine protocols, when we customize preventions, heartworm, flea, and tick preventions, to your point, maybe they can't physically give treats or they prefer an injection. But we live in a time where we really want to, you know, exceed the pet parents' expectations. Do you find that that's part of spectrum of care when we're having that customized, you know, plan in place?
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of our role and what frustrates us often in vet medicine is when we don't take that step to go the extra mile, is just eliciting their perspective. Right? Just being able to put our mind on pause long enough to say, hey, tell me what you'd like to get out of this visit, right? What do you want to prioritize? And if we can just take those 2 minutes, 3 minutes, it really doesn't take an owner long to articulate what those goals are. And if we can just hear them, that helps us tailor. And then we don't lead to frustration that happens when we dictate care and then there's a lack of compliance, like my Clavamox kitty. And my first gut reaction is, oh, the owner didn't do anything right. Why? Why did I waste that time, right? We see that all over the Not One More Vet posts on Facebook. And the reality is, just ask. We don't feel we can, or we don't feel we have the time, but it'll save the time later.
Right. There's a couple of talks, listeners, if you haven't caught them, I believe we have a couple of them on our DVM360 Flex by Dr. Engler. But I strongly recommend it. You have taught me so much about eliciting the pet parent's perspective, eliciting the cat breeder's perspective, eliciting the dog parent's perspective. Share with the audience what that means. I mean, just, I know you have lectures on this, but just like high level overview, because I really think it's very profound.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, what I see it as a partnership, right? And so there is a dialogue between the veterinarian and the client, and the client has a say in shared decision-making. That's what clients want, and that's what's shown in the evidence base. And what it means to ask or elicit their perspective as a client is to really say, well, what concerns do they have? What concerns them most? Why are they here, right? Maybe the dog's vomiting today, but there's something underlying that they're super concerned about. Maybe they had a dog that vomited before it was diagnosed with cancer, and that was a past dog. And now they're spending the entire visit not really concentrating on you or the exam or the plan because they're so worried that the dog has cancer. So it's really about saying, how can we help you? What are your needs? And usually, like, what do we want to prioritize, right? It's often we see a patient with 4, 5, 6 problems. We can't fix them all in that day. So we say, when it's not an emergency, to the client, of these 6, what do we want to tackle first? What can we do? And I think what that helps, it really grounds that care. It helps us to see what they need and can we provide that? And then if we can, great. If we can't, or if we have medical reasons why we shouldn't go that route, we can be transparent and use reflective listening. We can say, I hear you would like to prioritize X. Please allow me to explain why I really think we need to address this first. Then we'll come back to that. It gives that dialogue exchange so we all are on the same page and know where the perspectives are coming from.
So powerful. I mean, it's something that some of the listeners are like, well, I'm already doing that. But if you really stop and think about it, you really do. If you intentionally stop and listen to it, because an example that I've learned from your lecture is, we live in our professional and be like, well, my breeder said ... And me personally, that really irritates me because I learn so much from breeders. I really do. And I don't never, ever want to discredit any of that source of information. Tell me where your thinking is on that. You know, what's your perspective on why we shouldn't do X, Y, Z, or why you're recommending this? I want to know. I mean, I actually learn more information about specific dog and cat breeds because of what some of the research is done. And listen, we can't know it all as veterinarians. And like we just chatted earlier about this podcast and how it's a collaborative approach. But I do find that that's so powerful, just kind of taking a little pause and listening, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it is hard. And I admit that, you know, I'm not practicing now. We don't have a teaching hospital here, but we have similar conversations, right? And we work with faculty, work with students, we work with administrators. And I think, I know I've reached a point where sometimes you're like, it's too much. I don't want to listen. Yeah. We all have those gut reactions. So what we try to train our students is to think about how do we move from that gut reaction that, oh my God, they're mentioning a breeder again and I can't take it.
Right.
Two, wait a second. Why are they doing that? Okay, here's a person that's invested in their pet. The other one is Dr. Google, the cringe of, oh no, they Googled it. And I used to hate it. And now I say, okay, this is an owner that researched it. They may not have researched it correctly, or they might have found the wrong information, but they're open. They're researching, they're doing homework, yes. They want to talk. So this is someone I can work with. Let's harness the power and the wealth of let's partner, let's talk about it. Let me hear what you have to say. Because if I discredit or discount what they think of as valuable information or valuable sources, then I've already lost the consultation because they're done. If I bristle and I'm like, thank you and bye. That's a Google review. That's a Yelp review. That's a, I'm not coming back because the doctor was condescending. And so it pays to just take that breath and acknowledge it's a normal response we have. We all do it in every day, not just in the consultation room. And then say, what tools can we move toward modifying that from reaction to response? How am I going to respond in a way that's going to be appropriate and leave that door open?
Nailed it. I love that. Absolutely. And, you know, you wrote a book about this too, about the spectrum of care and communication. In fact, listeners, she has like, I think 6 texts or something, like enormous amount of, I just want to know. So tell us about the book you have that's like was trending on Amazon. Awesome. Congratulations. You have one on the horizon. So I want to know all of it. Tell me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll show the textbook baby because yes. It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Look at that.
Let's see. Look, it's not going to show up on my Zoom. You can appreciate the gorgeousness.
Yes. I like the colors, by the way. So it's purple on the color. And it, so tell everyone the title of it.
It's called Low-Cost Veterinary Clinical Diagnostics, and it's a Wiley-Blackwell textbook. I co-authored it with Dr. Sharon Dial, who is an amazing clinical pathologist, has taught me so much. I come at everything from the angle of a generalist, and she added in all the layers and the sprucing and the things that I had recalled, but maybe not with the immense level of detail. And so we started this textbook really as an avenue of thinking, how do we maximize the data we get from TUS? And it starts in vet school. And I think what prompted us is that often we as faculty expect our students to regurgitate every test under the sun to be complete, to be thorough, right? And we're trying to teach them to be comprehensive diagnosticians, which is great. But at some point, when you present a clinical vignette in class, any vignette, and we say, well, what tests are we going to run? We always get the same answer. It's CBC, chemistry, urinalysis, thyroid panel, 2 to 3 view chest x-rays, and an abdominal ultrasound, or some variant of that. And when we start to say, well, okay, tell me why you want to run each test, the why is missing. And that's not a student problem. In many ways, that's an educator problem. It's an education system problem, because we're teaching completeness for the sake of completeness, but not necessarily what we expect to get from those results. And so we decided, let's just scale it back. It doesn't mean there's not a place for CBC Chem, thyroid panel, all of those amazing tests. They have a purpose, but let's see, what can we get out of a Paxil volume? Let's have an entire chapter on how to run it, troubleshooting tips, how to interpret it, and all these cases that go with it. And so we started to do that for blood, and then for urine, and then for fecal analysis. And the idea was ultimately to put together this text that anyone, be it a student learner, a new graduate, a veterinarian in practice, heck, I've been out since 2008 and I've learned stuff from it. And so you can literally go to really almost any point of care test in the text and really see, wow, this is all I can get from this test. Do I need to go the extra mile? And maybe you do in some cases. And in other cases, oh, I can get all the information I need from that fat cell volume, that total protein. There's an entire chapter on urine color. Urine color, urine turbidity, urine smell.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And there's pictures, tons of pictures, because we're visual as a profession a lot of times. We use scent, so we talk about olfaction. I'd love to have a scratch and sniff textbook, but Wiley Blackwell wasn't keen on that yet, but stay tuned. One day I'll break through that barrier.
That's fantastic. It's a much needed book. I think it's wonderful. And then you have one that's on the horizon, I understand, right?
I do. So I wrote the text in January, and it is Supporting Pet Owners Through Grief and Grieving, A Veterinarian's Guide to That. And so anyone out there in practice has already been through that, lived through that. Many of us have lived with it on the other side, right, of the consultation table, when we ourselves are the clients, not the veterinarians. And so the goal was really to create a resource. This one is published, or will be, by 5M out of the UK, and it's anticipated to be in print in August. And so the hope is that it really walks people through the human-animal bond. Pet owners could read it as well as veterinarians. And it talks through what is grief, right? What is anticipatory grief? When does grief become complicated? When does it reach a point beyond which we can really help, right? What are the red flags that tell us we need to help journey and companion this client to someone else that is professionally licensed to help? And so I partnered actually with my mother, Jill B. Engler. She is trained in thanatology, and she's a licensed certified social worker who's made her career working in hospice. And so we really partnered together with that social work element and the veterinary medicine to blend, to really see what can we do to help people through that.
And what was that experience like working with mom?
It was really wonderful, actually. We actually are in different states. So it was different than I might have pictured, being like a side-by-side co-author. Right. But what was valuable, she really has immense creativity and has written a number of grief poems that have been published over the years for human bereavement. But when you read them, they don't say people. You can read them through a different lens and really apply that to veterinary grief and grieving. And so we were able to incorporate a lot of her poems as resources that clients may benefit from at different stages of grief and grieving. And so she also presented some vignettes from her own experience, both in childhood and in adulthood, right, from the lens of someone who's not a veterinarian, but has experienced grief as a beloved pet owner. And so I've really enjoyed the partnership in drawing upon areas of knowledge that I wasn't taught in vet school, but that I was raised with in the household. Part of that, I think part of me being raised by a social worker in hospice gave me comfort in dealing with end of life conversations, because that was normal for me to ask and elicit perspective of what the dying family needed. That's what I learned to do at a very young age.
Wow. Incredible coping skills to have, especially as a veterinarian. It's wonderful. Well, Dr. Engler, I could talk to you forever, as you know. But where can our listeners learn more about you and your books?
Absolutely. The best way is either to go to the Wiley Blackwell page. You can search that on Google if you like, or the 5M from the UK published books. Or most honestly, most of my listeners go to Amazon.com. I have an author page, very easy to find. And that really kind of, if you tag on to like or follow, it'll keep you posted on what books are coming out. And to be honest, Amazon fluctuates the pricing. So if you keep an eye on it, you might save $5, $10. I don't control the pricing, but it's cheaper to go that route. So if you're looking for some resources, definitely give it a look.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Engler, thank you so much for all the great work you're doing in this profession. You're such a light and positive energy. We definitely appreciate it. And thank you for all your great friendship. Such a wonderful friend.
Thank you so much. And next time I see you, we're going to do a tango. So get your shoes ready.
Those of you that don't know this, Sue, Dr. Engler is a professional ballroom dancer. So is that I know I asked you this before, but what is your favorite dance?
Oh, you know what? It's fair to ask me each time. It changes by the day. Yeah. My favorite is Paso Doble, believe it or not, which surprises all my students. Most of my students think I love waltz or foxtrot because they see me as very calm and mellow. Paso Doble, for those who don't know, is really the bullfight dance. I don't believe in bullfighting, but it's really an allegory. So it's not actually even about that. But what I love about it is the power that comes from both partners in the dance. And so I had trouble visualizing myself as the female partner for rumba or cha-cha or more of those sensual dances. I didn't know what to do with that. I'm like, that's great. I love the music, but what am I supposed to do? But Paso Doble is about power and like you're in battle and you're fierce and I can channel that energy. So any of the frustration or stress I had day to day, I love it. Plus, it's usually a battle between two forces. So good and evil. And I always make my dance partner lose. So I always get to win at the end. I stack the odds in my favor.
There you go. Excellent. Well, Dr. Engler, thank you so much for being on the show. It's always good to hear from you.
All right. You take care. And we'll see you soon.
You got it. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Thank you so much for your time. Please continue to do great work out there. And don't forget to rate today's podcast. It means a lot to us. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast Podcast. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast Podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay possum.